From the Moon Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. President Trump's inviting former CIA Director John Brennan to sue him over revocation of Brennan's security clearance. Trump tweeted a lawsuit would make public documents damaging to Brennan. Late last week, over a dozen former security officials wrote a letter of protest about the Brennan revocation. The latest on all things political right after the news.
KBCC podcasts are supported by SoCal Gas, offering rebates for solar water heating. It works with a customer's existing natural gas water heater to offer reliable and efficient hot water. Invite the strength of the sun into your home or business. Info at SoCalGas.com/solar.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you had a wonderful weekend. And it's back to school again in some districts, and so if you're headed back, you're there in your first day, we wish you all the best as summer is sort of gradually coming to an end. Coming up later this hour, Tesla founder and CEO Elon Musk spoke with the New York Times last week. He described a crazy work schedule, lack of sleep, and intense pressure to raise financial backing. The disclosure followed questions about Musk's judgment in announcing on Twitter a specific bid to take his company private. How do boards decide if or when the founder needs to step into another role? We're going to talk about that as Tesla's troubles continue. But first, just a couple of hours ago, President Trump tweeted his hope that former CIA Director John Brennan sues him over revoking his security clearance. After Trump took the action last week, more than a dozen former security officials released a letter warning about the danger to democracy of a president taking such action against a vocal critic. And as you just heard on NPR News, there are now three letters that have come out that have been critical of the president's action, saying it has a chilling effect on democracy. And you know, many of the critics of the president's actions are people who were not supporters of Brennan's very vocal critique of President Trump. With us is Lonnie Chen of the Hoover Institution at Stanford, research fellow there. Lonnie, good morning.
Good morning, Larry.
Let me start with you. First, your reaction to President Trump removing the security clearance from John Brennan, apparently because of the criticism Brennan has aimed at the president.
Well, it's obviously greatly challenging for the intelligence community on the one hand, because as they've noted, several former senior intelligence officials generally try to provide consultation and advice and counsel to current intelligence officials as they're addressing challenges that we face around the world. On the other hand, there is this difficulty that you have criticism that arguably is over the top. And I think that's why there is some sense that perhaps what the president did here, while not certainly something that we would want as a long-term precedent, does kind of create a unique situation, let's just say, with Brennan in particular. And there have been other intelligence officials, by the way, who've said that they don't like the way in which this was handled, but they also believe that some of the criticism was potentially out of bounds. So I can kind of see it in the light, both from the president's perspective, as well as from those who believe that what the president did was wrongful.
So what is the rationale for people, once they have left government, to continue to have the security clearance?
Well, the rationale would be that they need that clearance in order to have the ability to discuss sensitive operations or sensitive information that's classified at the highest levels, that they would be able to serve as advisors. A classic example might be for our purposes, if there was a case of a terror suspect that was pursued during the previous administration that this administration may have a bead on, and they may want to have a consultation with the prior administration with someone who has expertise or experience or background with the particular suspect. It would be very difficult to have that conversation if the prior administration official did not have a security clearance. That's the rationale. Now, what this administration is saying is, look, these people and these situations are exceedingly rare. And in fact, what these people do with their security clearances after government is to go and cash in on them, essentially to use that security clearance to advance their personal financial interests. And I'm sure some of that goes on as well, which is why this controversy has arisen.
Well, and the president tweeted about that over the weekend, about people using the security clearances to make themselves attractive to go on boards and get consulting work and things like that. Has this ever been controversial before, to your memory, Lonnie?
I don't remember this being controversial, and I think it is certainly the case that having a security clearance may make you marginally more marketable. The question is whether the marketability has to do with the security clearance or the fact that whether someone was actually, let's say, director of the CIA or has valuable professional experience in government that makes them attractive to private sector employers or potentially, as you've noted, people looking for boards. But no, this is not an issue that has stoked great controversy in prior administrations.
Are you concerned that the president's actions apparently in response to Brennan's criticism, that could have a chilling effect on other former people who worked in former administrations and have security clearances? They'll be afraid to be critical because they won't want to be in the line of fire to have their credentials revoked.
Well, look, I think just the opposite has actually happened. I think you've seen a number of intelligence officials in past administrations express their dismay at what's happened. They've been perfectly willing to speak out. There was an editorial in the Washington Post, I believe, over the weekend published by Bill McRaven, who was, I think, one of the senior military officials involved in the raid on Osama bin Laden, who basically said, look, if you're going to take away Brennan's security clearance, take mine away as well. So I don't think it'll have a chilling effect. I think the question really is whether this is the kind of fight with the intelligence community that we want the president and his administration to be having. Because at the end of the day, we do have some of the best intelligence professionals in the world. And to create a situation where there appears to be conflict between the intelligence community and the administration sends a very bad signal to friend and foe alike around the world. I think that's the bigger challenge.
We're talking with Lonnie Chen, research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford. He advised the Rubio 2016 presidential campaign, was policy advisor for the Romney 2012 presidential campaign. We're talking about all the controversy raised by President Trump revoking security clearances for John Brennan, the former director of the CIA. The president also threatening that he will be revoking other security clearances. That's led now to three separate joint letters with multiple signatories criticizing the president for his decision to revoke Brennan's security clearance. Also, big news on John Iadrola just joined us. Let's bring him into the conversation before I move on to our next topic. He's creator and host of the YouTube political talk show, The Damage Report. John, good to have you with us again.
Good to be back on the show.
So your response to now three letters that have come out critical of the Brennan security clearance revocation.
It's interesting because, look, I'm not going to pretend that prior to this situation with Brennan, I necessarily understood under what conditions someone who had previously worked in sensitive materials would retain or lose their security clearance. I'm sure there are reasons why they keep them in some cases. But I would say that my understanding and my expectation with Donald Trump is that he's not interested in any of that historical precedent, and he's doing, you know, the most juvenile version of what it appears that he is doing. He is striking out in whatever way he can to attempt to discredit or punish people who are outspoken critics of his, especially people who appear to come from positions of authority or knowledge.
And do you suspect it will have a chilling effect? Lonnie was saying he thinks it's having just the opposite. It's got everybody coming to Brennan's defense and being critical of the president.
I think that that's likely. I mean, there certainly hasn't been any lack of criticism of Donald Trump, before this. It seems to have only accelerated. I don't know, for more low-level positions of people operating in the CIA, NSA, the various intelligence services, I don't know what effect this might have on them if they have concerns that this sort of strike back could, for them, be more of a career ender rather than, the most recent, news cycle for John Brennan. So I'm not sure, but I would agree. It doesn't, at least in the short term, seem to have tamped down the criticism.
Lucille in Long Beach asks, why can't they just renew security clearances on a case-by-case basis? Does someone really need an ongoing security clearance, even if they're not in government work? Lonnie Chen, can you speak to that?
Yeah, so generally speaking, security clearances are time limited. So when you're issued a clearance, you're issued a clearance of a particular level, and there are a series of different levels of clearances that one can obtain. Top secret, by the way, is not even the highest level of clearance. There's actually an even higher level that refers to information that's compartmentalized and requires an even higher level of discretion. Now, those clearances...
Lonnie, I'm sorry, you're breaking up. We're going to have to see if we can get a better connection with you. Lonnie Chen of Hoover Institution at Stanford, John Iadarola of the YouTube TV political talk show, The Damage Report. John, let's talk about the New York Times reporting White House counsel Don McGahn spent 30 hours plus talking with investigators on Mueller's team. Trump says that he knew about it and allowed the meetings, although there have been other media reports that the president was incensed when he heard about the length of time that McGahn spent with members of the Mueller team. Your thoughts about the significance of the report?
Well, it's interesting because we have very little actual information about what was said at this point. We know that there was a great deal of talk. I honestly couldn't tell you how they could have filled 30 hours. Maybe some of it was talking about the, you know, the season finale of Handmaid's Tale or something. But that seems like a lot of discussion for what should be relatively clear-cut cases of did he obstruct justice? How did he characterize the investigation in your mind? But the thing is, at this point, we don't know anything specific that he might have said that might be incriminating. And the only indication in the original New York Times piece in reference to that was that Don McGahn had apparently asserted that, in his view, Donald Trump had not done anything that exceeded his legal authority, at least how it is generally argued. It is possible that Don McGahn, attempting to preemptively defend himself, might have presented evidence that the special counsel will interpret as exceeding his authority, while at the same time stating that he believes that Donald Trump hasn't done anything untoward. That would be a way of warding off accusations of disloyalty. But that's just speculation at this point. I don't think that we really have much information to go on.
Lonnie, were you surprised that Don McGahn had been talking with the Mueller investigators over this period of time?
You know, I'm actually not. Don McGahn is someone who has a great reputation in conservative circles. He's an attorney who has practiced law. He's represented a number of Republicans in electoral law issues, campaign law issues over the years. And it seems to me that what he is doing is he is, first of all, trying to protect the institution of the presidency, which is, you know, good for him that he's doing. But second of all, I think he is somebody who recognizes that it's not his job necessarily to be the president's personal attorney. In fact, that's definitely not his job. The president has personal attorneys who are responsible for defending the president in his personal capacity. And so what he is doing his job, in essence. He is serving as somebody who is doing exactly what someone in his position, who is a senior lawyer, the most senior lawyer at the White House, defending the institution of the presidency, is doing exactly what he should be doing. So I guess I'm not too surprised that Don has engaged in this activity, and I think he's doing exactly the right thing.
It sounds like from reports, and again, we don't know the accuracy of it. This is all based on sort of, you know, sources who won't go on the record, but the Trump's legal team might have been surprised by the extent of the conversations McGahn had with the investigators. Yeah, I mean, is that something that typically McGahn would share both with the president and his legal team?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to be clear that we don't know exactly what he shared with Mueller's team. We don't know exactly what he told the president's personal attorneys. There's been some reporting to the effect that you indicated, but we don't actually know what information or data was shared.
Mm-hmm.
That having been said, I do think it would be the case that standard procedure would suggest that to the extent that McGahn shared information that was relevant to the president and the president in his capacity as a private citizen, that would be information that he'd want to share with the president's attorneys so that they were aware of what was happening. But, you know, here's the challenge, Larry, more broadly with the Mueller investigation. None of us actually know what's going on. None of us actually know what Bob Mueller does or does not have. There's a lot of speculation out there. There's a lot of palace intrigue. But Bob Mueller runs an incredibly tight ship. And if we've seen anything, what we know is that he, first of all, is capable of striking in terms of indictments, in terms of findings at any time. And second of all,
we have no clue exactly what is in his possession. So to speculate on it, I think, is a little bit foolish, at least until we get his report.
All right. Lonnie Chen with us. John Iadarola coming up. Speaking of the president's attorney, we'll talk about his former personal attorney, Michael Cohen. Multiple media outlets speculating that financial activities Michael Cohen is alleged to have been involved with could lead to charges against him. Also, Rudy Giuliani said in interviews over the weekend that the Trump Tower meeting was to get dirt on Clinton, but that the Russian who was there wasn't a representative of the Russian government, and that no information provided was acted upon, therefore no collusion. We'll talk about what that means coming up. It's Politics, our every Monday sit down with experts to weigh in. Back in 1 minute. Great to have you with us this morning on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hey, coming up in our second hour, I'm going to open up the phones and talk with you about the job application cover letter. Been some stories that the cover letter is dying. It's no longer seen as effective in one making a case for an open job. But I'd like to hear from you. If you're someone who hires people, if you've recently applied for a job, what do you think the effectiveness is of the cover letter? And is its time come and gone? We'll take your calls. That's late in the second hour here on 89.3 KPECC. Right now, our focus on politics for the week. And we're joined by John Iadarola, his YouTube TV political talk show, The Damage Report, part of the Young Turks Network, and Lonnie Chen, who was policy director for the Romney 2012 campaign and an advisor to Rubio's 2016 presidential campaign, joins us from Stanford's Hoover Institution. Well, multiple media outlets speculating about investigation into financial activities of former Trump personal attorney Michael Cohen. John Iadarola, should any legal action be taken against Cohen? What is the potential exposure to the president?
Hypothetically, were he to strike some sort of deal with the investigation, he would perhaps have access to more information than conceivably anyone. I mean, Paul Manafort would certainly know quite a bit from his time leading the campaign. Jared and Ivanka certainly spend a lot of time with Donald Trump. But in terms of potential illegal activity, I don't know that we can point to anyone who would hypothetically have more access to that information than Michael Cohen. The trouble is, though, that while there have been multiple instances in which Cohen has alluded to the possibility of working with the investigators, and certainly, you know, by the fact that they raided his office, they got a great deal of information, it hasn't yet been clear from the investigation that they're actually all that interested in it, that they believe at this point that Michael Cohen has information that they desperately need or can't get from some other source. I would assume that if those charges are coming, we will know sooner rather than later if they are going to be working together. But at this point, it's looking to me less likely than I would have expected a couple of months ago after Cohen was initially brought in.
Lonnie, what do you think?
Well, I think it's certainly true that Michael Cohen has the keys to the kingdom in some ways here. The question is to what extent he's being cooperative and to what extent that information is going to be conveyed and be helpful as part of the Mueller investigation more broadly. But certainly I think the relationship between Cohen and Trump and that longstanding relationship is one that everyone has known about. Everybody has known that to get to Donald Trump, at least before he became president, he had to go through Michael Cohen. And so I think there is a lot of intrigue regarding what it is he knows and what it is he's told investigators. And I think only time will tell. But it is intriguing to see how that relationship may have soured over time, because they were clearly closer than any two business associates could be for many years.
The president's personal attorney currently, Rudy Giuliani, was making the rounds over the weekend at the talk shows and sort of paraphrased his comments about that Trump Tower meeting with the Russian woman who had claimed connections with the Russian government. Giuliani saying that, yes, the meeting was to get dirt on Clinton, but that she was not an official representative of the Russian government and that no no information was acted upon, therefore there was no collusion. Lonnie, first of all, what's the point in Giuliani doing all these interviews? I mean, is he really serving the president's interests? And secondly, what do you think of that claim, that the claim at least, that no information was acted upon, therefore there's no collusion with a foreign government?
Well, I think Giuliani, I think a lot of these interviews have frankly been a disaster from the perspective of someone viewing it who looks at what good representation of a client is usually like in a legal setting. Usually you would expect your lawyer to be making points that could help you, not hurt you. And if it is the case that the meeting, the Trump Tower meeting, was initially designed to get bad information on Hillary Clinton as opposed to information regarding Russian adoptions in a provision known as the Magnitsky Act, which has been the story all along, I think that is indeed a big piece of news and indeed an admission that coming from one's attorney is stunning. So I don't think Giuliani is doing the president any favors right now. With respect to the question of collusion, I think a lot of it comes down to what the intent was rather than whether, in fact, information was acted on. Now, there is no technical crime of collusion. The question is whether there was obstruction or whether there are other crimes. But obviously, if the intent was to act on the information, that, in my mind, creates a problem.
Yeah. John, what do you think?
I think it's – look, he can claim that it turned out that she wasn't an actual representative of the Russian government. We know that she has close connections. But regardless, we know the email chain that led to the meeting. Whether she ended up being an official representative of the Russian government or not, they were led to believe that she did represent the Russian government, that it was that they were going to attempt to help out the campaign. What's exciting about this entire thing, and a little bit frustrating sometimes, or exasperating, is this investigation had sort of been going on for months before we learned initially about the Trump Tower meeting, and the more we learned, it took months more. And so at a certain point, I think, because it had been so long, we can't simply accept at face value that we know what happened through the email chain, through the high-level campaign operatives that were dispatched to this meeting. They were told Russia wants to help Trump. They met. The highest-ranking people in the campaign went and met with her. They might have been frustrated about not getting the information or not, but we know exactly what happened. Whether that turns out to be an actual crime or whether Mueller actually pursues something, that's a different question. But we know everything we need to know about that Trump Tower meeting, and we know exactly how bad it looks.
All right. Paul Manafort's trial, of course, you just heard on NPR News, top of the hour, in his third day of jury deliberations. And once there is a verdict, if the jury can agree on a verdict, we will bring that to you here on KPCC. Omarosa Manigault-Newman released a series of tapes last week, including one late last week, claiming that Trump's daughter-in-law offered a well-paid campaign position, Omarosa says, to keep her quiet. I mean, it's just remarkable to see the way in which in her book and her media appearances, she's gone after the administration. It's Lonnie, in many ways, very Trumpian, the way that she's gone after her former employer.
Yeah, I mean, some of this stuff is absolutely shocking. And if you just step back for a minute and you realize that what we're talking about is implications surrounding behavior by the president of the United States, that's what makes it even more shocking and really, really jarring in a lot of ways. Now, look, Omarosa is not a real credible person because of the different points of view she's taken on the president just even within the last 6 months alone. And the fact that she would bring a recording device into the White House Situation Room is appalling for a number of different reasons. But I think, obviously, the fact that she has these tapes and no one has questioned the authenticity of those tapes, that's why this story continues. The fact that we get to hear the President of the United States and others around him who are close to him in their own voice talking to her and dealing with her, I think, has captivated public attention. And while I'm sure we'd all much rather be talking about matters of substance, the reality is that this is something that the media has garnered a lot of attention from the media, and probably in a lot of ways is perfectly understandable why that's the case.
Well, can you imagine someone else working in the White House recording conversations like this? We have any sort of precedent aside from presidents recording conversations?
No, I mean, look, the White House is not the friendliest place in the world to work. Not just this White House, but any White House. It's very competitive, and there are a lot of personalities and big egos. But the notion that someone would record their colleagues on a day-to-day basis is really shocking and a huge betrayal of trust. I can't see it happening. I don't believe it's happened before in any substantial way, certainly that we know about publicly. And for us to hear about this is really, as I said, it's jarring. It's fundamentally jarring to hear that some member of the president's staff, a very senior member of his staff, would engage in this kind of behavior.
So how does the president avoid the direct criticism? Because doesn't appear anyone else advocated for her hiring. He is the one who undoubtedly advocated for her being hired. He turned around and criticized other people that he's been responsible for hiring. How does this not accrue to his judgment?
Well, I think the president needs to accept responsibility for the fact that he made a bad hire. You know, we've all made bad hires in our lives and careers, and I think this was one that was obviously in the range of a bad hire. But look, I don't think we can expect the behavior of the president to change anytime soon. He has never been one to accept responsibility even when it's quite clear that probably the best thing for him to do is to do just that, to accept responsibility. And in this case, look, Omarosa did not come to the White House with a sterling resume that would suggest she was ready to be an assistant to the president and serve in a senior capacity in the United States government. But she was hired nonetheless, and that was a huge mistake. And someone, most likely the person who advocated for her, should take responsibility for that.
Yeah, John, your take on the Omarosa controversy?
I certainly think it's interesting that they would be willing to pay her so much money on a monthly basis, God knows how long into the future, to keep quiet. In this particular case, considering the amount that she's willing to say and the people are calling them the receipts that she's bringing, it was perhaps wise on their part to attempt to lock her down. But it is questionable that you would have apparently multiple of these sorts of deals with a former bodyguard, with Omarosa. You shouldn't necessarily need to pay off your former employees on an ongoing basis on just the belief that they might reveal something that they learned. Although I do agree with Lonnie that Omarosa herself I don't find to be a particularly reliable source. I'm not even that generally interested in her opinion. But if she has tapes, you know, objectively, I can look at that and perhaps be interested in what she's able to reveal.
Last Thursday, around 350 American newspapers ran editorials that were coordinated to push back on President Trump's criticism of news media and to make the case for why independent journalism is essential to democracy. The president responded saying that the newspapers were pushing a political agenda, also saying that fake news media are the opposition party. John, do you think it was effective of the newspapers to do this? Number of prominent newspapers like the LA Times, like the San Francisco Chronicle, did not take part in the coordinated day. What do you think of the strategy?
I'm glad that the newspapers did it, but not because I think that it was effective. I think that it was ineffective in a bunch of different ways. As was predicted as it was rolling out by many people, it plays into Trump's framing of the media as being involved. And he literally said that they were colluding with each other. I don't know if he knows what the word means, but it certainly plays into what he has attempted to get his supporters to think about the media. And more largely, I have a feeling that many of his supporters were not reading these newspapers to even see the message anyway. So I'm glad that they did it. I don't think that it's probably all that effective in getting across the message they want. But I think that this fight needs to be waged, because even in the wake of all of those editorials came out, he once again was labeling them the enemy of the people. He has been doing this many times since the fatal shooting, you know, in that newsroom. And I believe, and I've said it many times, that this is a conscious decision on his part, that even if this sort of messaging makes it more likely that there are more murders, more harassment, more intimidation, and all of that, he is apparently of the belief that it is worth it, that this is a thing that fires his base up.
Right.
And if that potentially threatens the media, so be it.
We're short on time. Lonnie, your thoughts on the strategy and the president's response?
The response was predictable. The strategy was also predictable, not particularly effective, because this is kind of what the media does, is it props itself up in a lot of ways and feeds right into Trump's argument, I think. So, you know, I'm sure it made them feel better. I'm sure it made a lot of their readers feel better. But at the end of the day, it doesn't move the needle one bit at all.
Gentlemen, thank you. Always appreciate your being with us on Air Talk and our Monday political roundup. That's Lonnie Chen of the Hoover Institution at Stanford, where he's research fellow, advisor to the Rubio campaign, and policy director for the Romney 2012 presidential campaign. And John Iadarola, YouTube TV political talk show The Damage Report, part of the Young Turks Network. We'll be back with a look at what happens when boards think that CEOs need to move into another position. How do they do that? We'll talk about that after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Tesla founder and CEO Elon Musk gave an interview to the New York Times last week, and in that piece, he sounded like a man at the end of his rope, describing a crazy work schedule, lack of sleep, intense pressure to raise financial backing. The interview followed questions about Musk's judgment in announcing on Twitter a specific bid to take the company private. There are apparently concerns within the company about how Musk is handling all that he's taken on and with the continuing cash crunch at Tesla. So it raises the question, how do boards deal with founders, particularly those considered by supporters to be visionaries, if they feel like it's time for someone to help the founder out or to move the founder into another position? Certainly Uber went through this with Travis Kalanick, who exited the CEO position last year. But it can be difficult if the company really is the direct result of the vision of the founder. With us to talk about Tesla and other companies that have gone through this is Jeffrey Pfeffer, professor of organizational behavior at Stanford University, author of Power, Why Some People Have It and Others Don't. Professor Pfeffer, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be with you this morning.
So this just seems like it's fraught for boards to be in this position where the company is there because of the founder, but there are questions whether the company can continue under the founder. How do they address this?
Well, I think the first thing everybody needs to recognize is that this is not an unusual situation. Noam Wasserman, who teaches at Harvard Business School, reports that by the time you've raised three rounds of funding, 50% of founders are gone in the CEO role. And ironically, the more successful the company, the more likely it is that the founder is going to be replaced relatively early. That's because you bring in outside money, and the outside money often wants its own people in charge. So this is actually not unusual at all. As your listeners, I'm sure, know, there are numerous organizations that have had their founders pushed out.
Well, and this case is interesting because Musk not only has Tesla and its challenge to come up with a more affordable version of its all-electric vehicle and coming up with next-generation battery. They've got SpaceX, and he's got his hands in so many different things. I mean, is the case where the board could go to him and say, look, you're just spread too thin?
Well, he is clearly spread too thin. I mean, when you read the interview in the New York Times, it strikes me that this is exactly what you would expect for someone who's facing sleep deprivation. We live in the Silicon Valley, of course, is filled with this, in this idea that, you know, the more hours you work, the better off you are and the better off your company is. But we know from tons of research on sleep and sleep deprivation that people do not do their best work when they're exhausted, that people often do not make their best judgments when they're exhausted, and that you need to be able, particularly if you're facing substantial challenges, to have enough rest and recuperation so that you're not overly stressed. And so when I read the New York Times piece on Musk and his interview, it struck me that he is suffering all the classic issues of sleep deprivation. First thing he needs to do is take some rest.
We're talking with Professor Jeffrey Pfeffer of Stanford University. I'd like to hear from you as an Air Talk listener. If you've worked for a company where this has played out, where the founder who has created the thing, made it possible, just gets to a point where it's a tremendous challenge to continue to run the company as the company itself has changed and and perhaps the CEO founder is just burning out. We're at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Also with us from Arizona State University, Professor of Management Mansoor Javedan. Professor, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
So what are your thoughts about this? And you know, what is the successful way that a company can go through this as opposed to maybe some bad examples of companies that have imploded without the founder?
Besides being an academic, I've had the experience myself of working in an organization where the CEO was forced to resign. This is a very traumatic experience for any organization. Boards would be extremely reluctant to take such an extreme action. So I can feel for what is going on in the boardroom and what is going on with Elon Musk or founders of corporations like that. The process of getting to a point where any board of directors who represent the interests of shareholders to sit down with the CEO and start having a very unpleasant conversation about, well, maybe this is the time to move on or create a new leadership in the organization. It's very difficult for a number of reasons. One, it just sends a negative signal to everybody, all the stakeholders, that things are not going well. Now, in the case of Tesla, I mean, that's already been obvious that things are not going well. But boards would take a lot of time, would do all kinds of things to avoid getting to a point of having a conversation like that. Because of the turmoil that it creates inside the organization or and outside the organization. What, as Professor Pfeffer mentioned, with companies that are founded by brilliant and creative people like Elon Musk or Travis Kalanick at Uber, these companies build, these creators build strong cultures inside their own organization, and they have a strong following inside the organization. So their departure, even for very good strategic reasons and financial reasons, does create a lot of negative repercussions for the people who joined the company. For many people, it's because of the CEO.
Yeah, that's what brought them in. It's a great point, Professor Javedan. Let me go back to Professor Pfeffer and ask you, Travis Kalanick of Uber seemed to be a little different case because Uber really has proven itself. The financial model, it's got regulatory hurdles and New York is cracking down on it and the like, but still the basic model seems fully solid. In the case of Tesla, its future is much more iffy, and I wonder if that then exponentially raises the challenge of finding someone else to either assist Musk or replace him at Tesla versus the Uber model.
Well, it's interesting. As I said before, the research suggests that actually the more successful you are, the more likely you are to get replaced, not the less likely. And part of that is because nobody's interested in taking over a failing organization. But when the organization is doing well, it's much more in play. The thing I would point out is that mostly this is around interpersonal dynamics. The problem with these founders is that they often believe that because they founded the company, it's in quotes their company. But of course, once they go public or once they bring in outside money, even through VCs, it is no longer their company. It's now the public's company or the investor's company. And they need to understand that they have a boss. And just as if you upset your boss, you're probably going to be gone. If the founder does not do a proper job of cultivating his or her relationship with the board and with the outside investors, they're going to be gone. So this is mostly about political dynamics. Travis, people get fired, people lose their jobs, not so much because the company isn't doing well, but because they have upset and hurt their relationships with their bosses, the people who can keep them in power. So Travis, I think, was not sufficiently deferential. Elon Musk is clearly
that's a very benign way of putting it, not sufficiently deferential. We'll continue with Jeffrey Pfeffer. He's professor at Stanford University, Mansoor Javedan, professor at Arizona State University. Again, I'd like to hear from you. If you've worked for a corporation where this issue of the founder sort of hitting the limits of what the person can do in the job, how did your company deal with this? 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. Back in 1 minute. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking about Twitter and the use of Twitter by Elon Musk, in which he, to the shock of many people, including myself, when I saw the tweet, stated a specific share amount that he had backing to pay to take the company private. Well, that has led to all kinds of repercussions. The Securities and Exchange Commission also looking into whether the company actually has the backing available to go private. We haven't really gotten an update on whether there's that ability of Tesla to go private or not. And we're talking about whether the time has come for Elon Musk to move into another position, someone else to come in. New York Times, in that lengthy interview with Musk, said that members of the board were supposedly looking for someone who could help Musk, who would be like a number two, perhaps, to be able to help him with the tremendous workload. But our guest, Mansoor Javedan, Arizona State University professor, can you imagine a founder like an Elon Musk sort of working side by side with someone else?
Wow, that's a really interesting question. People like Elon Musk, who have a lot of creativity, a lot of great ideas, also very strong, charismatic personalities, and also big egos, and they have a track record of success. They've done a lot of good things. They have a lot of people working for them who look up to them in very strong, emotional ways. A few years ago, I had long conversations with some of the direct reports of Elon Musk. And the way they spoke of him was far beyond a typical CEO. There is a very strong emotional bond that exists or has existed between people like Elon Musk and their followers, their employees. So for a person with that kind of background, that kind of personality, that kind of success track record, to be willing cognitively and emotionally to work with another person and kind of let some of that control go, boy, that's a real...
It's hard to imagine. Yeah.
Decision. Even if cognitively they may believe it's the right thing to do, emotionally to let go of it, in many of them would see it as a big failure on their own part. So they'd be very reluctant.
Let me take a listener called Judy in South Pasadena. You're on Air Talk.
You know, I have worked in the high-tech industry for 30 years. I've been through this cycle of founders and running companies very often. I also worked at SpaceX. And I have to say that I am not in the cult of Elon at all. But SpaceX is an exceptionally well-run company. Elon has a great relationship with Gwynne Shotwell, who is his number two in command. And I find it very plausible that he could back out of that functioning, profitable company and really have a chance to prove himself at Tesla. He can step in, devote himself 100%, and turn that situation around. It would be a great chance to prove that he's worth the hype and rescue that company.
Well, and what you're depicting, Judy, with SpaceX is that he was able to delegate there and let someone really run day-to-day that operation. And
maybe
he could even have assistance in running in Tesla. That might be. Yeah.
I think he can do it. The thing about SpaceX is I would say 35 to 40% of internal resources, human and process, are devoted to how the company runs and to making sure it's done well. Every company should work that way. And if that's applied to Tesla, it's possible to save it.
Judy, appreciate your call. Thank you so much. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. If you've worked in a company where this issue has come up, the founder appears to be having difficulty dealing with the challenges of the company down the road, how does the board deal with that? How does the founder get assistance or be moved into another position? Professor Pfeffer, you know, one of the big challenges here, though, is Tesla is so much about Musk. It is so much about the vision that he puts out there, the promises he makes, the if you don't call it a cult, at least the boosterism that people buy into with Tesla. If he's not there, is the company still functional as it is with him there?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the reasons why such a high percentage of founders lose their jobs, the companies don't disappear. As a matter of fact, the skills required to found a company and to have that initial vision and the skills required to execute on a day-to-day basis are often two different things. I think Elon Musk is obviously a visionary. Whether or not he can run an organization that's a manufacturing operation, that's a whole other thing. If you look at the case of Apple, when Steve Jobs came back, and as he reached towards the end of his life, he brought in Tim Cook. And Tim Cook actually helped make Apple successful, not because he was a great product visionary, but because he could rationalize Apple's supply chain and handle manufacturing and all the other day-to-day, if you will, implementation issues. I mean, strategy is a piece of company success, but execution is way more important than strategy. The problems that Tesla faces is not does it have a vision about electric cars, but the problems that Tesla is, can it manufacture electric cars? And I'm not sure Elon Musk is a great manufacturing executive. And by the way, I would also point out one other thing. Elon Musk may have a great cult of personality, but the turnover in the executive ranks at Tesla is enormous, as, by the way, it was at Uber. So one of the reasons why founders lose their jobs is not because they have so many people who are so devoted to them, but because, in fact, they are so abrasive and so toxic that senior executive talent leaves. And one of the changes that Steve Jobs made late in his life was his ability to work better with people. And early in his career at Apple, people left in the droves. Late in his career, he was much better able to attract and retain talent.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you so much for sharing your insights into what Tesla's going through with the founder, CEO Elon Musk. By the way, we contacted Tesla and asked if Elon or someone else in the company would join us. We have not heard back from them yet. My thanks to Stanford University Professor of Organizational Behavior, Jeffrey Pfeffer, and Arizona State University Professor of Management, Mansoor Javedan. You can share your comments about what happens when the founder's CEO becomes highly stressed as the company is under tremendous pressure. The AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Coming up in our second hour, we're going to take a look at the future of the cover letter. There are some experts who say the cover letter is dying. The resume gives you all you need to know, and the cover letter is extraneous or perhaps even harmful to someone's efforts to land a job. But I'm going to open up the phones. I want to hear what you think about that coming up in hour two.
KPCC podcasts are supported by SoCal Gas, offering rebates for solar water heating. A solar water heating system doesn't replace your existing natural gas water heater. Instead, it helps by preheating the water with the warmth of the sun to help you use less energy. When you install a system at your home, you'll still have the hot water your family relies on for baths, showers, and laundry. You may save on your SoCal Gas bill and get rebates that may cover nearly half the system's cost. It's the strength of the sun in your home. Learn more at SoCalGas.com/solar.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. Hope your day's going very well. Coming up later this hour, we're going to look at a long, wrongful death lawsuit filed in Sacramento County, which looks at the issue of suicide by cop and when officers are justified in using deadly force against someone who is attempting to use police or sheriff's deputies to commit suicide. It's quite a poignant case. We'll touch on that coming up later this hour. But first, the news that Charter's Spectrum Cable franchise here in Southern California will soon be establishing a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week, all-local news channel for Greater Los Angeles. When I was recently in New York on vacation, I saw Spectrum's channel there, which was devoted to news. In fact, when you turn on your television, and if you're a cable subscriber, that New York news channel comes up first thing right away. You're kind of forced to look at it before you move on to other channels. So Spectrum looking at establishing a Los Angeles channel, that despite the fact that local television news is on the air weekdays in L.A., all but 1 hour of the day. Joining us to talk about Spectrum's endeavor is Cater Lee, Spectrum Network's Vice President for News and Content. Ms. Lee, thank you for being with us.
Oh, good morning, Larry. Thanks so much for having me. I'm a huge fan of your show.
Oh, thanks very much. Well, first of all, share with us what the niche is that you see that's available in local news.
It's funny, Larry. I spent many years of my career doing local news here in Los Angeles. I'm very proud to say I have many colleagues who I have the utmost respect for at many of the at KNBC, KCBS, KCAL, the CNN West Coast Bureau, the Today Show West Coast Bureau. I worked in all of those places, and I think that they all do a fantastic job of doing what they do. I think what's missing is what Spectrum is able to offer, which is what attracted me to this job a month ago, the ability to go even deeper into the communities in a hyper-local way. Because it's a cable company, they're able to actually go into the neighborhoods in these very discrete zones so that we can actually have reporters all over Southern California in a way that if you live in Pasadena, you get a different feed for some of our community news than you get in, say, Anaheim. So you really can cover news in a hyper-local way. I know that at many of the stations over the years, you know, we've had Orange County bureaus, Inland Empire bureaus, Ventura County bureaus. A lot of those bureaus have come and gone depending on the budgets, of course, and staffing at the stations. But it was always difficult to get out into those communities because it really has to be a DMA-wide interesting story for the network affiliates to go out and cover it. You know, to take a live truck and to go literally 2 hours from where the station is located, it has to be a story that the editorial staff deems interesting to the entire audience. That's not the case for us. We're able to actually hone in on the audience we're serving.
So that's a
point of difference.
That now it sounds pretty expensive what you're talking about, because if you're essentially going to have bureaus in each of your regional franchise locations, let's say for Orange County or maybe even subdividing the county, you're going to have the technology at each of those production centers, right?
Well, remember, it's a cable company, right? So, you know, the same fiber that is feeding homes all across Southern California is also feeding our bureaus, if you will. We're not really calling them that, but we do have the ability to feed out stories. In essence, it's like having four different television stations in one location. We're sort of splitting up the Southern California region into four sort of discrete zones so that we can become more hyper-local. and serve those communities even more. I would venture to say that there's a lot of things that happen, say, in the San Fernando Valley that people in Orange County aren't interested in, and vice versa. But there's still really important stories to tell.
And what are the four zones? Can you give us the breakdown?
Well, I like to say we're sort of dividing L.A. in north, south, east, and west. That's the best way I know to describe it. We're not doing, you know, necessarily a I don't want to call them anything because it's so impossible, as we know here. You would never want to say it's a valley zone because it also covers much of Ventura County. And, you know, so what I like to say is we're doing the best we can to get geographically, because we're covering such a huge geographical area, we're able to zone in even more with boots on the ground. So what we're doing is we're taking the entire Southern California DMA, splitting it sort of north, south, east, and west, if you will, and putting boots on the ground all over those zones.
We're talking with Cater Lee, Spectrum Network's Vice President for News and Content. Spectrum announcing that it's launching a full-time local news channel, as we just heard from Ms. Lee, that's going to be customized depending on which of the local franchises you have. So it sounds like there'll be cutaways for more localized sorts of content within the hour's programming that the channel provides. If you have questions for her about the channel, which is to come, we're at 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722. You can also ask on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. What's your target for the number of journalists you're looking to hire?
We're hiring 30 reporters and putting them out all over Southern California. And, you know, I think, again, one of the differences, you asked me, sort of in a market that is very saturated, how do you stand out? And one of the other things I think that, you know, for me is what drew me back to local news and drew me back to doing it, especially in my community, in my the place where I live and love, is the fact that I think that the news that we see is often not reflective of the experience we live. I believe that Southern California is a wonderful place to live, and I'm raising my family here, much like, you know, many of your listeners, and I think that, you know, we do care very much about the communities that we live in, and we want to see that reflected in the news. And so often when I turn on the news and, you know, I see news that's honestly depressing, a lot of random crime, a lot of stories that I think the relevance is just missing. So I'm hoping that we really take that tone, that we're looking to not put on rose-colored glasses and not say that bad things don't happen in Southern California, because they certainly do. But we're going to try to look at solution-focused stories when we're talking about issues. And we're really going to stay away from random crime. You won't see it here.
Obviously, in the video business these days, exclusive content is extremely important. We see that with entertainment channels. Already, Spectrum has the Dodgers exclusively on television. And I'm assuming this is one of the things you're hoping will develop an audience and keep people who might be tempted to cut the cord. But given that local TV news generally skews older and that it's younger people that are the more likely to cut the cord, do you think that in terms of it, you know, attracting viewers or keeping people from canceling subscriptions, do you think this channel will make a difference in that?
I sure hope so, Larry. I think one of the most exciting things for me is building a team of young journalists. And what I find when I'm talking to young people, they care deeply about their communities. And there are so many great content creators here in Los Angeles. One of the very first things I did when I got here was to say, we're not looking at reporters from across the country who might be, you know, doing the traditional route of graduating from a journalism school, going to work in a small market, medium market. I mean, I did that myself. But I think what's unique here and the way that we're hiring, we're looking for Los Angeles, Southern California-based storytellers, people who know, who are from this area, who know this area, who don't necessarily look like they belong maybe on traditional affiliates. We're not looking for, we're looking for people that reflect the audience that we serve. And so I'm finding that I'm hiring a lot of young filmmakers. They may never have in a million years applied for a traditional TV news reporter job. But they know Southern California really well. They specialize already in, say, the environment or in social justice or in, legal issues. These are specialized journalists who know Southern California and who are passionate about telling stories. Many of them are already telling their stories on blogs or in print or in radio or in other ways, and this is giving them a different outlet.
Cater, what about other lifestyle, food, sports, some of the things that we know have been very effective getting clicks and online news services. Is that sort of lifestyle kinds of things we also planning to be included here?
Absolutely. Oh, my gosh. This is such a foodie place, right? With so many fantastic places to go. I mean, I thought Jonathan Gold was the master of being able to not just tell you, dining reviews, but to actually tell you that taco truck on that corner that you have to go to and you have to try those tacos. I hope that we can capture a lot of that. And sports is a huge story here. I mean, it affects everything we do. Our economy, we have huge sports fans. It's a lot of goings on with the stadiums and the road to the Olympics and so much. Yes, I mean, we're looking for, again, specialists in all those verticals that can tell the great stories of Southern California.
We're talking with Cater Lee, who's Spectrum Network's Vice President for News and Content. Let me also bring into the conversation Cynthia Littleton, Managing Editor of TV for Variety. Cynthia, thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you.
What do you see as some of the challenges that Spectrum faces with this endeavor?
Well, I think, as you pointed out, there is a lot of news in Los Angeles. All of the major local stations produce news hours, and they have been increasingly adding hours of news, 4 a.m., middle of the day, late afternoon. It is, it's local news can be a very lucrative programming for a station, and it's also a great way to, if you can get viewers in the habit of coming to your news team and getting to know your anchors and being familiar with the mechanics of your newscast, when the traffic report comes, when the weather report comes, that breeds a kind of viewing loyalty. What Spectrum is trying to do is different, as Cater said, that focus on very hyper-local can be, certainly for people in the market for that kind of news, that can be very attractive. I don't think you can underestimate the importance of Charter right now wanting to feel like it's giving viewers a reason to continue to write that monthly check for the cable service.
How does this compare, do you think, with New York, where Spectrum has their channel there? I had a chance to watch that, and there was a lot of what seemed to me much more kinds of political news about the city there than you ever see on broadcast news here in Los Angeles.
Yes, very much so. It's actually kind of surprising. Truthfully, it's surprising that L.A. doesn't already have a local cable regional news network. Charter is coming in. Charter took over what used to be Time Warner Cable for years, and Time Warner Cable has at least half a dozen, that Spectrum now operates, at least half a dozen local regional news channels. They have one, they have an established one, New York One in New York City, which is very, very well established and part of the fabric of the city's news coverage. They have one on the other side of the state that covers the rest of New York. So they have a pretty established presence, and they do a good job of covering Albany, political issues in Albany and, you know, what's going on in the streets of New York City. So it's a pretty expansive operation. It's kind of surprising, given that L.A. is the number two media market, that they didn't have that for years already in Los Angeles. So it certainly is late to be coming in, but I think the ability, especially the technological advantage that Cater discussed about being able to really hone in on regions, and they can also, they'll be able to, once it's up and running, they'll be able to see where they have pockets of viewership. If they have a lot of viewership in the Valley, you can bet that they will be covering a lot of Valley news. If they have a burst in on the West Side, you know, you'll be seeing a lot of news about Santa Monica and West LA.
Now, I hadn't realized, one of our producers shared with me, you'd mentioned KCBS is launching a 24/7 online news channel with their news resources. I hadn't heard about that.
Yeah, that is in a very nascent stage. But CBS 2 weeks ago announced that they are going to get into the local streaming news business. They're going to start with the launch that will be based out of their owned and operated a TV station that CBS actually owns in New York City. They're going to start with hyper-local streaming 24/7 in New York that will come out of their existing station in New York. And they have said, they said at the time they made that announcement, that LA is number two on the list, and that it would originate from KCBS. And the truth is, you know, any TV station, any news director would tell you they do way more reporting and way more news gathering than they can put on, even with all these increased hours.
Cynthia, thanks so much. Really appreciate your giving us an overview of this. She's managing editor of TV for Variety, Cynthia Littleton. Gabriel Kahn, professor of professional practice of journalism at USC, thank you so much for being with us. Professor, what do you think of where this channel could fit in the local news market?
So, hi, Larry. So first of all, I applaud any effort to bring more coverage to Los Angeles. I agree with Cater. I think it's chronically undercovered, and I think that there's a lot more that can be done. I think that this initiative faces some serious challenges that have more to do with the state of the industry and viewing habits and things like that. First of all, as you noted, the group of cable subscribers is a shrinking pie, so you're fighting over generally, you know, a smaller number of viewers each year. And I think that it's a great idea to try to sort of divide Los Angeles, which is such a vast area, into different sort of markets. However, once you do that, you're also diminishing the revenue that you could derive from that content, which makes, I think, the sort of business model here a little more challenged. The other thing is just that people's viewing habits are changing dramatically. And what we've seen a lot is people trying to innovate with a sort of video news style service, but one that is either delivered over Twitter or YouTube or some of these other platforms, which can give you much more nuanced user data. And it's often where people are spending much more of their time. So I think, you know, those are all factors that this plan is going to be fighting against.
Professor Kahn, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us. And let me get a quick comment here from the executive director of the Radio Television Digital News Association, Dan Shelley. Dan, good to have you with us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry.
Your thoughts on this, and do you think this, aside from major markets where these channels might already exist, we might start to see more of these in some of the mid-sized markets?
I hope so. I hope Charter will expand not only in L.A. to complement its half dozen or so existing regional cable news operations around the country, including where I am, New York City. You brought up the Spectrum cable news channel here, which is indeed part of the fabric of the community, as I think Cynthia said. But, you know, what we're seeing is a constriction in the newspaper business all over the country. And RTDNA commissions research every year to measure the workforce in local television and radio news. We also measure the number of reporters with boots on the ground, if you will, in the newspaper business. And it's an annual research project. And this year, For the first time in nearly 30 years we've been doing this research, we found that nationwide there are now more people employed in local broadcast newsrooms in America than there are in newspaper newsrooms.
Wow.
Now think about that for a minute, and what a sea change that is for journalism, not just the way people are consuming it, but the economic forces behind that. And I applaud Charter. I applaud the Spectrum cable channels, the one coming to Los Angeles and others around the country, for stepping up the game and trying to fill in those gaps where hyper-local news often does get ignored.
Dan, appreciate it so much. Thank you for sharing your thoughts. He's executive director of the Radio TV Digital News Association. And Cater Lee, just real quickly, timeline for the launch of the channel?
We're launching in the fall. We're launching, our timeline is November of 2018. And
wow.
We're building every week.
You just started a month ago and you're going in November. Wow.
Yeah, we're deep into, Charter has been doing a ton of research on this. Even though I was late to the game getting started in July, the research, the data, the study of the market has been going on for a long time. This is the vision of Mike Baer, who really championed this. And, you know, I hope that we will become the cultural phenomenon that New York One is today and essential to the viewing habits of people in Southern California.
It would be great, because the more significant, in-depth, straightforward news of our region, the better. And that's a huge service. And we're pulling for you, wishing you all the best. Cater Lee, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Spectrum Networks VP for News and Content, the forthcoming Spectrum Local News Channel, making its debut in November. Coming up, we'll talk about the phenomenon dubbed suicide by cop. To what degree are officers responsible for trying to de-escalate a situation, and what degree of risk should officers and deputies have to take on when dealing with someone intent on using officers to take their life? Back in 1 minute. Coming up in just a few minutes on Air Talk, is the cover letter dead? Some people in HR have said, you know, cover letters don't really tell you a lot, a waste of time and energy for both parties. Better just let the resume or examples of work speak for themselves. I'm someone who relies quite heavily on cover letters, and there are particular things that I look for in a cover letter. In a few minutes, I'll tell you what those things are, but I want to hear from you at 866-893-KPCC. What do you think about the potential death of the cover letter? Would there be a lot lost if we didn't use them? But first, a so-called suicide by cop incident is at the center of a civil suit against the Sacramento County Sheriff's Department. It raises the question of what degree of risks officers are expected to take on versus efforts to de-escalate such incidents. 2 years ago, Sacramento deputies responded to a call from a woman concerned about the behavior of her depressed husband. She said he came home drunk and behaving erratically. After deputies arrived, the woman's husband grabbed a knife. According to witnesses, he asked the deputies, "If I come at you, you are going to shoot me, right? It's over. I'm going to die." He then approached the deputies. One deputy opened fire and killed the man. Now his family is suing the sheriff's department. This case is scheduled for trial this coming January. So the tragic incident raises the question of what degree of responsibility officers take on to de-escalate a potential suicide by cop, and how much risk should law enforcement take on to try and keep someone from using someone else to end his or her life. With us is Justin Ramsdell, who is crisis intervention trainer for Arlington and Fairfax counties sheriffs and police departments in Virginia, also assistant professor of psychology at George Mason University. Professor, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So as you see this, kind of where do you draw the line, and how far should officers and deputies have to go in risking their lives to keep someone intent on suicide potentially alive?
Well, I think it should be recognized that, first off, that officers have an incredibly difficult job. just on a day-to-day basis. But second of all, when you're talking about a situation in which your officer-assisted suicide or suicide by cop, whichever terminology you're choosing to use, then it falls in a interesting in-between category where you've got someone who has probably some form of mental illness or at least emotional distress who is intent on hurting themselves. Whereas if we're talking about someone with a mental illness who's not being violent, there's no intent. There's no violent intent there. They just may happen to be committing a crime or trespassing, and so officers can de-escalate that situation one way. If you've got someone who without a history of mental illness who is being violent, then the officers are going to approach that scene in an entirely different manner because they're going to focus on stopping the violence. And when it's suicide by cop, you've got this combination of both of those things, right? So you've got someone who is having some emotional disturbance who is also intent on violence, but violence to themselves. And whether or not officers put themselves in harm's way is ultimately their decision and how they feel. But the important thing for them is to keep themselves safe, to keep the bystanders safe, and do the best they can to de-escalate the situation while keeping the suspect safe.
I'd love to hear from listeners. If you have worked in law enforcement and have thoughts to share about this, I'd really welcome your observations. If you've had a family member who attempted or successfully took his or her own life in a confrontation with police, I would welcome, I know, incredibly painful experience for you, but welcome your insights and your observations about these kinds of incidents that we hear about very frequently. 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722. If you have worked in law enforcement or are in law enforcement, your thoughts about the phenomenon of police-assisted suicide or suicide by cop. Also, if you've been on the other side of this and had a family member, a loved one, a friend who had a confrontation with police in just this kind of scenario, 866-893-KPECC. Also with us, clinical forensic and law enforcement psychologist based in Boca Raton, Florida, Lawrence Miller. Also works with a wide range of police departments, including the West Palm Beach PD. Lawrence Miller, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
What are your thoughts about the challenge this presents to law enforcement?
Well, I agree with Professor Ransfeld that once the decision has been made that deadly force is required, police officers really don't have much of a choice. You know, the decision of whether a police officer is going to fire his weapon really has very little to do with the person, their motive, what's behind it. It's really based on the exigent circumstance that the officer feels that their life or someone else's life is in danger. I think where a lot of these cases come from, much as the one you described, is some ambiguity and indecision at this point in what exactly is the standard of care for trying to nonviolently de-escalate a situation before it becomes violent. You know, what I teach in my classes is the best form of crisis intervention is crisis prevention. It's a lot easier, or most of the time, a lot easier to prevent something from becoming a crisis before it starts than to try to put out the fire once it's been lit. And I think although there has been a movement in many municipalities for training of police officers in crisis intervention, and I think Justin would agree with me that the basic principles of crisis intervention are really universal, whether you're talking about suicide intervention, hostage negotiation, other types of crises, the basic types of person-to-person interdiction of a severe emotional state cuts across different types of crises. And those police officers who are able to de-escalate a situation, whether it's a suicide, a hostage crisis, or just a plain standoff, are the ones that are going to have less of a need to use deadly force. But what I think people need to understand is once that decision has been made, there's no going back. The key is what can we do up to that moment to try to prevent us from having to use that kind of deadly force.
Well, and I would think in the work that you do with police departments that one of the big challenges is officers, I'm sure, resent being put in this position that, you know, unlike trying to, you know, stop a violent crime or something, here they're essentially being asked by the person in distress to do something the person can't him or herself do. And you know, so do you have to deal with those feelings of resentment in those cases?
Here's what I found. Many of them are afraid of this type of intervention. They resent this type of intervention until they learn it and get good at it. Because once you've learned this as a tool, you know, what I often ask my classes is, you know, because a lot of cops, as you say, they're kind of suspicious of the sort of verbal type stuff. They tend to disparagingly refer to it as social work or we don't get paid to talk to people. Well, in fact, 90% of what a patrol officer does is talking to people. So I ask them, do you guys have a SWAT team? Well, yeah, we have a SWAT team. On that SWAT team, do you have a set of hostage negotiators? Yeah, we have hostage negotiators. Are those guys social workers? No, those are tough guys. Well, what do you think they're doing? They're using two essential elements that every police officer should be able to use, and that is their brain and their mouth. And once officers learn how to use these types of skills effectively, they suddenly have a new attitude. Not all of them, of course. There are always going to be some holdouts. But when you teach somebody something new, some skill they can use, and they see that it works, then it gives them a whole different range of options other than just having to shoot, especially in a suicide by cop incident. After it's over, police officers feel terrible because they've essentially been manipulating into doing somebody's dirty work for them, and cops hate to be manipulated. So if they can find some way of talking somebody out of, whether it's killing themselves, killing another person, doing some other kind of violent act, and do it in a face-saving kind of way so that the person involved doesn't feel like they're backing down or surrendering, then that's a powerful tool. And hostage negotiators use this all the time, which is why hostage negotiations have approximately an 80 to 90% success rate.
All right.
Effectively negotiated. So why not teach these skills in some form to all police officers?
All right. I want to thank Lawrence Miller of Boca Raton, Florida, and Justin Ramsdell of Virginia, George Mason University professor. We have a good call we're going to take as we continue on the program. Also, our phone lines are open for you to share with us in the final segment whether you think the cover letter in a job application still has utility. Does it serve a purpose? Or do you think, as many experts now say, the cover letter has outlived its usefulness? 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Back after a live update from Hetty. The software company JobVite, which is a recruiting company, surveyed a couple thousand workers and found that about half of Americans don't send a cover letter when applying for a job. When you look at younger workers, 18 to 22, that number jumps to 58%, which might seem counterintuitive, given they'd have less work history to put on their resume. Also, Office Team, the site, found that one in five senior managers is all said that cover letters are very valuable. In other words, 80% wouldn't say that they were highly valuable for the hiring process. I'd like to hear from you what you think about the cover letter and its apparent impending demise. Is it time for the cover letter to go, or does it serve a valuable purpose? I find it highly valuable when I'm looking at prospective AirTalk employees, and I'll tell you why coming up in a little bit. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. But I did want to take just a moment. Philip in Beverly Hills, who's an attorney, called in. We were talking about this last topic of what's called suicide by cop. Philip, share your experience briefly, please.
Okay, I guess we have a lot of mental patients have drug issues or problems with mental health that we have as clients. They always get in trouble. There's always a criminal past if you look at their history before they do this suicide by cop. I've had a situation happen in Santa Monica where a client of mine about 2 years ago wanted to end his life by suicide by cop. He called me to let me know that he was thankful for what we were able to help him with, and he was going to do this thing. So I ended up calling Santa Monica PD and letting them know in advance what was going on, so we were able to divert it, because instead of bringing in police full force. They brought in, like, what's called before, someone from the social work as well as people that deal with hostage situations.
Yeah, so like an intervention.
They were able to calm him down and divert the situation, get him mental health, and not either put him back in the criminal system or kill him. But I think it's important for attorneys to have an extra special relationship with mental health patients and their families, because the only reason why he was able to get a hold of me was he has my cell phone and contact me anytime day and night, is what I told him. So I think attorneys should also play a role in keeping track of their clients, because they have played a vital role in saving their life.
Well, it sounds like you sure did in your client's case. And Philip, thank you for sharing that. Really good to hear about how this worked out and in the best interest of your client. Thank you so much. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Quick reminder that Terry Gross coming up talks with Kevin Kwan, best-selling novelist. He wrote Crazy Rich Asians, and Terry talks with him about his childhood in Singapore. That's coming up on Fresh Air with Terry Gross. We're taking your calls right now about the cover letter in the job application. Is it extraneous? Is it necessary? What do you think? Teresa, in Studio City, you're on Air Talk.
Yes, I think that the cover letter is really important, Larry. It tells you a lot about the individual person. And I think a problem that people are having these days is they're using a robo resume letter that they're getting offline. And all that does is they just fill in the blanks, and it doesn't tell you anything other than they don't even know how to write a resume letter. So I usually pass on those. I'm in a position of hiring people on a pretty regular basis, and they're mostly under 33 years of age. And I see a real disparity on in terms of age about people who know how to write a resume letter.
Do you feel like the cover letter gives an accurate sense of the personality of the applicant?
It does, if you can tell it's personally written. As I say, if it sounds and it reads like a letter that's been computer generated, then no, it tells you nothing other than they don't know how to write a letter. But I think that the personality of the person, the way they highlight what they think their personal strengths are, whether that's initiative or working well with others or skills they might have that aren't in the job description, but they're intuitive enough to know might make them stand out in the crowd. I think a cover letter really tells a lot about a person, and I would encourage people to write them and write good ones. Keep them short, not too long. But a cover letter to me is very important, and I always read them.
Teresa, thanks so much. In Studio City, I have to say for myself, I read the cover letter before I look at the resume, because I'm looking at a number of things for someone applying for a job with Air Talk. I'm looking at familiarity with the program. Are they knowledgeable about what we do? Have they been listening for very long? Do they reference specific episodes, what they liked about it, or what they think they would bring to the program? I'm interested in knowing what their interests are when it comes to news coverage. If they haven't worked in something similar in the past, I'd like to know why they think that this is a transition that could be successful for them. In no way can a resume convey that kind of information. Only a cover letter can give you that kind of customized sense of how the applicant sees him or herself, how they see any deficiencies they might have in experience that they think they could bridge nonetheless because of other attributes. Only in the cover letter are you going to get that. But I'd like to hear from you for a job application, or if you're someone who hires people, what do you think the utility is or isn't in a cover letter being part of the application package? 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Jan in Long Beach says, I've been in staffing for over 20 years. I think cover letters are dying out because a lot of companies use a system with algorithms looking for keywords, and those resumes are then selected and reviewed. So no cover letter is necessary. Wow. Again, I just can't imagine hiring someone without having a cover letter. Even choosing who you're going to interview, because if you know, I'm sure this case for you, if you're hiring someone, you get a lot more applications than you can possibly have time to interview people. That cover letter is where the person can truly reveal herself, let you know what they're able to bring to the job, or any, you know, specifics that simply don't show up on a resume. 866-893-KPCC. We'll be back with more conversation on the future, or maybe the past, of cover letters in 1 minute. A lot of changes have come to the hiring process through technology. HR managers say that recruiters increasingly turn to online platforms, personal websites, or LinkedIn to find the right candidates. Job seekers often use mobile technology to connect with a job. 2014 Glassdoor survey found 9 in 10 job seekers use their mobile devices to get a job. So as the application process has become more app or online focused, does that mean the cover letters days are numbered? What do you think? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Anthony in Silver Lake, what do you think?
Hi. Yeah, I run a public relations firm, and I'm looking for someone right now, so this kind of hits a nerve because I think the cover letter is incredibly important. I pay more attention to the cover letter than the resume. One, it talks specifically to me, and the other is there I know whether this is just a scattergun resume that's being sent out to 100 people without any consideration to the job or what I'm looking for, or if it's tailored towards me.
Yeah.
And not having a cover, that's funny. When I get submissions without a cover letter, I just delete right there.
Yeah, yeah.
So to me, it's more important.
I'm with you, Anthony. Thanks. 866-893-KPECC. The other thing, if it's a poorly executed cover letter, that tells you a lot right there. If it's not really on point as to what the job is or the entity where you're seeking a job, if it doesn't really show they have a sense of what the mission is, what the intent of the company is, none of that's there. It kind of tells you that this is just someone looking for a job, not that they've really thoughtfully considered what they would be bringing to this position. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Nicole, in Mid-City LA, what do you think?
Hi, I'm about to open a restaurant and I'm hiring an entire staff, so I'm deep in the cover letter and application process. I think cover letters are very important. I think having someone check the spelling on your cover letter is very important. I think adding a personal note, a knowledge of the industry you want to break into or your previous knowledge of the industry, just in a couple sentences, says a lot about who the person is. And not relying too heavily on the form app process, or the robo letter process. The best cover letters I've gotten and I've hired people from, one of them came through Instagram because that's the only way that they could contact me. And I hired that person. She's worked for me for 5 years.
So Nicole, if you got a cover letter from an applicant for a position with your restaurant that referenced maybe previous restaurants that you had had or that you had worked at, that commented on the particular approach you're taking with the new restaurant and why that appealed to him, you got a cover letter like that, how much credit would you give that applicant?
I would almost not even look at their resume because I'm confident in my leadership skills that if that person has a genuine interest and passion, I might hire them knowing that I might be able to take them to the next level of their career.
All right. Nicole, thanks so much. And good luck with everything at the restaurant. Thanks so much. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Mark in San Pedro is a job seeker. Mark, what do you think about this?
Well, I like a cover letter. I'm able to convey thoughts, ideas that the resume wouldn't. I work in sales, and a lot of times I can show people I can express myself, my writing skills, all these things that are very important, I think an employer would like to learn about.
Yeah. And do you find that you're getting better responses with a cover letter? Are people responding, or do you think they're not even bothering with them?
I've always used a cover letter, so I don't have experience.
Okay. All right, Mark, we wish you all the best in getting a job quickly, too. 866-893-KPECC. Scott, in Redondo Beach, your opinion of the cover letter.
Hi, Larry. Just like Anthony said, there are a lot of people who send things out scattershot because of platforms like Indeed and some of these others that don't allow, you know, people to send in their cover letters. I have a college prep company where we ask people to send a funny anecdote as part of their cover letter. And in running the company for 17 years, it has been the number one thing when we all talk about potential candidates that we look at, because the resumes are very, you know, form by nature. You know, everyone can go and kind of follow the rules of a good resume, but the cover letter and the anecdote for us really shows the personality and their desire to actually, you know, stand out.
Yeah, because I would think the resume is going to show you, you know, what the academic chops are of the people that you're hiring to do test prep, but it doesn't give you a sense of their personalities and how you think they might be able to interact with the young people that your company services and all that. I would think cover letter would give you much more of that.
Yeah, and the anecdote actually that we do actually shows us kind of their humanity a little bit. If someone says they think something is funny and we find it off-putting, or if they actually are self-deprecating, we find that charming. You know, there are a lot of nuances that come through in the cover letter that just could never come through in the resume, and it's absolutely invaluable. And it's too bad that a lot of the platforms are kind of stripping it down, so people are scattershotting.
Scott, I appreciate it. Thanks very much. Michael in Upland, your thoughts on the cover letter.
Yeah, I'm an active job seeker right now, and I've applied for jobs which require cover letters and those that don't. And I found that for jobs that require a cover letter, I've been able to talk about my experiences in a way that are not easy to do on the CV or resume. And I feel like it lets my personality come through, like a couple of callers have said previously.
That's good. And we wish you all the best on getting a job. David in Santa Monica, I understand you're a cover letter skeptic. Share your perspective.
Yeah. So the thing is, you know, I graduated law school a couple of years ago, and applying into the legal field, it's a competitive market, and I probably wrote like 50 cover letters. And the thing is, we all have college or university career centers that help us draft our cover letters. So I hear everyone talking about how they show through your unique skills, but the form is actually taught to people all the time to just replicate, just in the same way a resume is. And oftentimes, you know, I hear people saying that they read the cover letters, but in my firm now, we hardly ever look at cover letters.
Really? Because they're just so pro forma. Well, and wouldn't that lead someone then to want to do something more original? But I understand, David, if you didn't think it was going to get read, why invest the energy in it? David, thank you so much. Victoria in Pasadena said, I was recently applying to jobs, and even though some of them didn't require a cover letter, I still did it. She said, there was a lot of value in me writing the letter. I felt much more prepared for the interview process and could hone in on my skills, and I got more job offers. Victoria, that's great news. Thank you for sharing that. Stay tuned. Fresh Air with Terry Gross is next. I'll be back with you tomorrow morning at 10 for the next Air Talk here on KPCC. Have a superb day.